Maybe we could get them to move the speaker sign up a little bit.
Life is so complicated.
Yeah,
yes. Say test. Yeah, I figured, and then you'll join in.
I think
we'll start. Yeah. Or when? Okay. Well, what? Just a little bit. Oh. And welcome, welcome.
For those who might be listening at home, we'll start very shortly.
Thank you.
There's no sound on. All right. Well, it can't be this. There's no power going into it. Where's that sound coming from? Well, who knows?
Welcome, everybody. I'm Jeffrey Leppenberg, Executive Director of the Flowchart Foundation. Welcome to the Flowchart Space. Toward opening new possibilities for discovery, thought, connection, and joy, we explore poetry and the interrelationships of various art forms as guided by the legacy of John Ashbery. The Ashbery Resource Center occupies the second floor. Come on back if you'd like to visit that. You can just write to us and make an appointment. And if you're not on our mailing list, please sign up. I'm going to send it around if you're not already. We do many, many things. Most of them are free. In fact, this Thursday, we have a long-running series now, Closer Readings in a Virtual Space, a very lovely, non-hierarchical space to explore poems. This Thursday, Evie Shockley will be leading us through a Jane Cortez poem. You can just listen in. You can take part. Everyone's equal. They're all really, really great. And you can find recordings of all of the past ones on the flowchartfoundation.org website. We're also live streaming on WGXE Radio, Radio for Open Ears. So hello, Radio Land people. And we are here this early evening, Mother's Day, to celebrate Door by Anne Lauterbach. Among a few epigraphs at the beginning of the book, is one I particularly love from Simone Weil. We want the future to be there without ceasing to be the future. And it's just a particularly wonderful line to open up this book, this adorable book, let's say, that has so many different kinds of doors in it. And it seems perfect that this is really our first formal reading in this space, since the very core of our mission is possibility. And doors are such symbols of possibility. And Anne is such a poet of possibility, and of the future being something that we all like to think is always possible. We'll see later as we have a conversation with Charles Schultz, who's here from the Brooklyn Rail, editor. I don't know if Anne would call these pandemic poems, but I think they were probably largely or all written during the pandemic. And of course, the pandemic, as awful as it was, as horrible it was also a situation that opened doors for many people, particularly creative people, and perhaps I will talk about that later. But I think if you haven't read the book already, and if you know Anne's work, you will probably, like me, be very struck by some of the doors that are open. Doors are open to TikTok, and to the great British baking show. Paul Hollywood and Prue enter into one of the poems, through one of the doorways. And we have many, many other deep explorations of Dur. There are repeated Dur poems throughout the book. And speaking of say, Prue, for example, I think only Anne could transform Prue into Rue, which is how one of the poems goes. And then Durs, of course, can be portals. They can also be barriers, sites of promise, all kinds of things that you'll hear. Wonderful discursive sites, as Anne says, beyond language at one point. I should say that prior to Dur, Anne has published 10 other books, three of which are collections of essays. She's been recognized with fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, a finalist for the National Book Award, many, many other honors. She is the Ruth and David Schwab II Professor of Languages and Literature at Bard College. Quite a mouthful, but she holds well. And I just want to say a couple more things. We will have Spotty Dog, our wonderful indie bookseller up the street, will be here shortly. There will be books available following the reading and discussion, so if you don't have one, hopefully you'll leave with one. I think we can convince Anne to sign a few books. And finally, I'll just say that in The Blue Door, one of the poems in the book, Anne writes, "Too many questions spoil the poem. But I promise you, we will have exactly the right number of questions from Charlie at the end, and perhaps we'll get to answer them too as well." Finally, just to end with another quote from the poems, words are like small magnets, pulling other words toward them one by one and now to pull us all in and not. Many, many years of doing this, you stop being nervous. It doesn't happen that way. And sometimes to quell my nerves and try to get my voice to be less in my, caught in my throat, I like to read an early poem to as a sort of warm up. So this early poem. I'm going to try and keep track of time. So I have a few here. It's okay. I was divided between two poems from my very first book, which was called Many Times But Then. And it was published in 1979. Seems like a very long time ago. And I guess the one that I'm going to read of the two is Parables of Spring. Something slips through the element of truth and tosses like a seed in a cardboard box. The Chinese fiancé did not show up, but the alcoholic painter does, by just applying himself to nonstop work. For 3 years, they slept back to back. She learned to tell lies. He believes the pain is in his head, not his life. You can't walk through the streets all fuzzed up. The day flickers unsteadily in a paper cup. I'm not used to the lines that leave things out, and this slide through seasons is arduous and slow. The process of waking hurts. The way dreams have a habit of your name or your face. Somewhere outside city limits, a habit of flowers is getting underway. The scarf is light, the earth moist. So as it turns out, door, dedicated to the memory of my grandmother, whom we called Shaw. And she was a remarkable person, had 5 daughters who had children. So it's dedicated to her and to the progeny of her 5 daughters, one of whom was, of course, my mother. My grandmother, in the end of her life, spent her days in her bed reading Jane Austen. And I once asked her rudely, sitting on her bed, Shaw, why do you read the same book over and over? And she looked at me and she said, well, dear, I hate surprises. The first door in door is this door. World fills up, imperious pace, vagrant matter into the humming, pooled at the feet. What soul went down what inventory, mud, slippage, tracks, marked shells, anointed there the ravenous reel flowering above torsion of waves, unexpected, threshold, thrown open, crossed. B.
Must flower, sweet enclave, moon, so much for not turning up, there inevitable, my inevitable, must have flowers, pretty gold dark, never autumn. Speak without reverence and mind your wings, mind later. Must mind matter, flower, dear, not sun. Then the beautiful differences thrall this plural, its gap, conscious, bald, bloom. Figure any of us into marginalia, to be noted, deleted, swiped in daily illusions of hope. Oh, must flower, must allow permeable inclusions, blessed semblance noted, as if spawn. This is hand, Giotto. It's for you, Dorothea. So, in both of you know, Giotto's work, most of you I'm sure here do, the hand is an extraordinary kind of emblem that appears in all kinds of dispositions. And in the sequence that's in the Arena Chapel in Padua, there are several of his frescoes that have, they're about Joachim's dream and his sacrifice. Joachim, I think, the father of Joseph, who was had to leave, was sort of thrown out of his world and sent to the desert. So there are these two paintings in which Joachim is struggling on the desert. And one of them is called Joachim's Sacrifice. And in that painting, he's crawling toward a building that's on fire, and there's a single hand that descends out of the heavens, just a single lone hand. So it's an unbelievably uncanny picture. It's called Hand, Giotto. Over here, the circle theme continues without a clock, uncountable and unmarked, despite a pouring sound, despite slight lesions in the rock. A hand is waving silently from under cover of cloud we said was blanketing the sky, and so indeed the sky is blank, but for a reverie of reach and touch, the ancient, fingered dark. The word I was trying to recall is fungible, but it doesn't mean what I thought, so now I need to trade it for another, one that means porous, means mutable, means a shadow can pass through unnoticed, means you turn and nothing before comes after. Nothing takes hold. I'm a little unsure about this poem, but I think I want to read it. I'm a little unsure about the poem. I'll give it a try. If I don't like it, I'll stop. I don't love it. I'm gonna stop. I have lines in it and the whole thing. I don't think I have time for it. I want to read some poems at the back of this book, and then afraid that I won't get to them, so I have to be. Yeah, economy is not my main strength. Table. People gather, and they eat, drink, speak. They are among themselves happily. They celebrate this or that occasion. The cat does not like the cat door I installed. It is not transparent. I removed the flap Now the cat goes through an open opening. A distant sound, a small engine in the sky. I recall planes at night when I was a child. I feared they carried bombs. There is something called a transcendent table. That is, the table does not exist, but the idea does. Plato's table. I wish to be clear. Clarity is not the same as the literal. I object to the literal. What does this mean? We had better pay attention to what we call about, we care about. This is an economy of means. To observe that life pivots between care and neglect. My mother, an alcoholic, was cruel when she was drunk. She inhabits the pole of neglect. Care within a paradigm of neglect is tricky if there is no thought of the transcendent table. Okay, Jeffrey, this one's for you. Ingredients. Maybe you and I are the only two people who ever watch the show. Ingredients. Went through, turned, looked back. Is this paper? A scene? Are they kissing? In profile, perfect. Nose to lip to chin, but not an image, not photography. I rest my case. My case is resting like dough. I went through hoping to greet you on the other side. Moon? Hello. I might have called into the sky. Hello. It might have been a question. What is this word, hello? It holds some dark components, some poor ingredients. I speak at times of a poem's ingredients as if I were making a pie. What would Paul Hollywood make of my poem pie? He would say, I'm not getting it, to it being a flavor I said I had added but did not come through, the crust underproved. Prue is kinder. She compliments verisimilitude, the sweet decorative touches essential to taste. What shall I make today? I'm going to the market to get some eggs, some milk. I will see what is fresh. Blueberries. Rue. Fable of the barn. Voice, behave. I did a recording for Audible of this whole book. So the first time I went down to this recording studio, which is in the basement of a jazz musician in New Paltz. And so I went down into the basement, and there was a chair for me to sit at, and the microphone very close, and the producer was in earphones, so he could talk to me. I never saw him, so I only saw the jazz musician, who was a very nice person named Jason. So I started this, and my voice completely seized up. I absolutely could not. It was way, this croaking, it was a croak that was not possible to say words out of. So we tried to go deep, honey, the whole thing. It didn't work. I left. I came back the next week. I said, I have to stand. And I know. And what happened was the producer, whenever I missed a word, like I said, on that last poem, I said it has some something about, instead of components, I said companions. So he interrupted me, and he said, that's not right. So then, of course, I couldn't go on reading the poem. So when I came back the next week, I said, let's call him Bill. Bill, if I make a mistake, would you not correct me while I'm reading the poem, but when I I'm finished, let me know what I did wrong, and then maybe we'll get somewhere. We got somewhere. See, I'm taking up all this time. Well, I'd like me to chat so much. Okay, no more chat. Fable of the Barn. A green truck is passing, carrying chance, but no way to clean the windows or to kill the stink bugs in their gray shields, their slow march up, their endurance. If I look away, I will find some words that don't belong to me, stolen, borrowed, or apprehended at the cost of an alphabet, its acquisition of knowledge, of song. Singing along, I am five again and happy in the sand, or unhappy watching how the boys make things from blocks. I would like also to be making things, but not from blocks, maybe from paint. When I made a painting, there wasn't any time. How to not have time? Paint. Or wander away from what you know into strangeness, a sure way to cancel time, or to make time fill up and not empty out into the missing encomiums of memory. This adventure hurts my heart, someone said uneasily, crossing the bridge and entering the opening in the newly painted barn. A season was waiting there with sheep and goats and small rodents making the dry grass move slightly as if in a film. The barn was there with the books and papers, brittle and frail in boxes, eaten around the edges, dry as dry grass. We need rain, another said, which will cure you of the past. The downed leaves look bloody on the ground, I thought, and then wondered if the poem is a way of thinking to oneself or thinking to others. As if you were here as the words come, and we both wonder if we were ever in the barn. And light? The light was like a kiss as the air shifted, so there were new shadows and the scent of hay and dung and a bright turquoise egg hidden above the broken window's sill. And who were then looking into the mouth where Aesop had spoken to the leaping creatures and went on his way across the continents, carrying a stick to move the grasses and to hit the stones on his path and to help him across the muddy waters streaming into the sea. Along the way, he would sing, but we cannot know the tune, fast or slow, melodic or off pitch, voice low or high, nothing of the sound, even as it seems he could hear what the turtle, what the hare, what the stork said, what meanings they made from across the centuries into our unbelief. Ethos. Someone must have predicted this, some Jeremiah not leading in the new renewals of the new, the ineluctable flower. Someone must have seen this coming, someone familiar with if-then relations, someone looking down, back hunched with bending, following the dark ground, following the track, who saw the tunnel and water sluicing through, the fires leaping, ravenous, melting, copper pans, killing the dog. In high school, a teacher introduced the idea of an ethos. It was difficult to comprehend. What was an ethos? Our teacher, Mr. Cooper, spent some time defining ethos. We were reading the Odyssey, so I suppose he was talking about ancient Greece, its ethos. Are we at the end of an ethos? I am, not, but we are. as if we included me. We were reading the Odyssey, so I suppose he was talking about ancient Greece, its ethos. Are we at the end of an ethos? I am not, but we are. But if we includes me, then I am. A young man, Joe, is working for Verizon. He is almost 23, he tells me. He and I are waiting for the service phone to pick up so he can change my forgotten Verizon passcode. It is very hot outside. We are on hold. He doesn't appear eager to engage in conversation. He must think I am an old woman who forgets more than a passcode. He has dark hair and dark eyes and is very thin and not tall. Is attention a form of retention, of preservation? Is this why numbers as facts matter? Anyway, waiting as we were on a hot July day, we begin a conversation. He tells me he has been enlisted and had served in Kuwait and Iraq. I don't recall why he told me, perhaps because I had asked him about working for Verizon. There is a painting in the Alice Neal exhibition at the Met called Fuller Brush Man. I did not read the wall card's description because I find them mostly patronizing. In any case, I wondered how many of the crowded melee of viewers knew what a Fuller Brush Man is and recalled that a man came to the door with a suitcase full of brushes for sale. Mom, we called, the Fuller Brush Man is here. Simone Weil talks about attention. To what should we attend? Attention is a form of response, not just perception. If you attend, you respond. Otherwise, you are in an aesthetic morality, pleased with yourself for seeing. We see and we say, but what do we do? This question sits like a huge stone on top of modernity's ethos. We're getting there. I'm determined to read these other poems, though. Yes, we'll be okay. You're all okay? Still in the, too uncomfortable? Hearsay. What did you say? I said. And in that dream, I was married to her, and she, I don't know who she was. Perhaps she was you. Perhaps only me marrying a better me. Perhaps now drilling down into its absurdity like a mole in the grass whose head got bit off by my cat. Before it was a metaphor. Like or as, I always forget. It is too hot and the garden is sad, moving to its final stage, never a pretty sight. I too am moving to my final stage. Stage is also an interesting word, as we think perhaps, of Marlene Dietrich or Nina Horn or Prince. They then I danced to with my then BF in Minneapolis. Oh, Minneapolis. What did they say, he said? The garden is sad, it is too hot. The trouble with doing things on a hope in some words is they don't always come true. All men are created equal. All that talking the talk, saying the said. What did he say? I said. And after the final stage, when one has walked or been dragged off so the whole scene is as empty as the glass on my bedside. The glasses by my father's bedside were kept separate while we were quarantined for polio, which killed him. But then I would try to find him in a dream. Word was that Marlene Dietrich made a pass at him, and I have a gold-plated knife he stole from the embassy in Moscow. Someone used the knife to pry something open, so it is damaged at its point, the way things get damaged by ill use. Do words get damaged by ill use? Scratched, torn, stained, dulled down to their thinnest shadow, the shadow of lies and cruelty, as when you wandered out of earshot. So I'm going to end with two poems and the last door. It's good. The two poems are very long. So the first one is Company, which is indeed a pandemic poem. And the pandemic for many of us was not just this interiority, but also a kind of reckoning. So it so happens that the pandemic coincided with a very particular reckoning for me. And so this poem is an attempt to reckon with the reckoning. Company. Take me with you. These were already worn, these gloves. I prefer the question previously raised in that other year among strangers, quicksand and strangers. And the aesthetic questions, ignore them. They are old, they are dust. The moon, also dust, from time to time illumined with a bright wish, ignore it. I might ask to be released from turbulence if only you would forgive whatever sin I committed, as if in sleep striking with my glass sword the fixed mountain with its false gold sunset, peeling the glue from my fingers, sleeping in my sweater. The dawn begs, do not wake up. Why stampede when the ghost of Anne Hutchinson is shivering in the snow, still whispering, I desire to know wherefore I am banished. Works, grace, footprints, the wet alignment of dream sex somewhat resembling. Lovers, their postcards, meetings under the eaves, all the long summer days. Look aside. Forgive me. Step across the boundary where a rude addendum is carved into urban stone. They went from pause to glittery pause, carrying boxes made from bark torn from dead ash trees. The bricks were darkly stained as if they had wept oil, the oil massed, distributed like a thick emptiness. Take me with you. I have lost sight of the girl holding a bag filled with constellations yet to be drawn. Did you follow her? Where to? The numbered cards were all the same suit, red and black, 1 to 10, their small nouns stacked like memories into order. She awaits the fool, his slain pet, his hungry eye, the way to pass the time in winter. A magician from an earlier game, long since gone. Did you follow her? It's better to be so thin, just like looser in here. Did you follow her? Where to? The numbered cards were all the same suit, red and black, 1 to 10, their small nouns stacked like memories into order. She awaits the fool, his slain pet, his hungry eye. One way to pass the time in winter. The magician from an earlier game, long since gone. You see how one dawdles when information is scarce. You see how the glass is marred with fingerprints. They were already used, those gloves. The necessary foils, a curtained agenda, blown out, So we face the dark, blissful, and ordinary as clouds arranged as bodiless wings. Quickly, quickly, metamorphosis happens, and a radiance burns through despite adhesions, despite the familiar stench lingering in history. Under this alphabet, there is another, recessed and tangled, its charge carved into rings of hair, rings of bone, its vocabulary remote. Learn again to speak. The observed world, your iterations, images, stories, ceaseless pictorial strums masquerading as language turns from sight, even as the bird feeder lies on the ground and warm air pulses thin paper like disturbances among the departed. Leslie in claret velvet smiling, Joe holding a glass, shirt open, so pleased to be Joe. Stacy standing with Chet by the window on Duane Street, her face half lit. John speaking from his long shelf, mildly, ever kind, in the cruel regime of the perpetually cruel. They there, the unapproachable crowds, molecular dust. She copied the assignment down word for word. She made a list, hoping to loosen its grip on the foliage. She changed her masks. She wiped the breath from her glasses, thinking of Salon and of Arendt, thinking mostly of Blake. A gang of white boys smoking assembled at the corner in their tight shirts and jeans, their polished hair. And Louise, her unborn wrapped in burlap and hung from the ceiling like huge wasp nests. The hemlock also wrapped against deer for the winter. The mother bleeding clutched half a strand of pearls. The rest returned to the sea over which fireworks cascaded upward, miraculous as spider webs. What, she wondered, is precious? Let us try for once, Kentridge had said from the library stage. The cost of change disappears, he added. Where? Into the momentum of immaterial delirium, hidden beneath the salty waves, to mingle with the accumulated tears shed for the newly dead. On the round table, a pinkish glass bowl filled with dry magnolia leaves. She wished not to look back. She wished to stay, to believe she might go on ahead. Now, as always, it is early. It is dawn. Take me with you into the day. Let me carry your tools. Let me help you over the stream. Intense discrepancy performs its sabotage. She vowed to show up, but now, as always, it is too late, the day half gone into blank, the man unknown, his hand on her breast, perhaps a doctor, perhaps someone's brother or father or son. Who would mend the basket? Who sew the hem? Who lift the bleeding boy up off the street? What economy caused this? What threshold crossed, skirt muddy, hands swollen with tasks an ancient song had preached? Christmas Eve, I announced I wanted to have a conversation about materialism. There had been no gifts. Everyone was lonely and bereft. Everyone, no exceptions, not even the beloved. The remark fell into the stormy night like a shooting star, invisible, so no one made a wish. No one said, what? Remember when the ferry pulled away from shore and the receding land seemed increasingly phantom as it flattened a silhouette against the horizon like Catalina Island behind this poem on the screen? It was that kind of moment, arrested, distant silence. The reverie faded too, with its ribbons and bulbs, tinsel twisting in the breeze, the kids on the bed with their stockings, walnuts and mandarins, and balls wrapped with surprises. What did you get? A frog and a bell and a green plastic ring. You failed, said the fool from his stool in the closet. You failed the test, and you can't do it over. As if there were a story. As if it could be told and told again without variant. Not a single word out of place, like a ballad sung generation to generation, carrying its sentiments forward on its old tune. Repeat after me. Oh, oh, oh. The song always begins with an O. The O's are behind me now, obedient as pets. The fool isn't talking to me. He's talking to you. All right, should we have time for one more? A special request. Charlie asked me to read this. This is The Blue Door, and it's dedicated to my great, wonderful friend, Kenward Elmsley. And it occurred to me, coming here today, that my selected poems, which was published also 100 years ago, was dedicated to three people. It was dedicated to John Ashbery, Barbara Guest, and Kenward Elmsley. And then I was thinking today that those three people constituted my chosen parents. And I was so incredibly lucky to know them and have them as great friends and wonderful poets, and each of them completely different from the other, so that one had a kind of what we call a various gene pool. We just had a memorial service for Kenward at the Poetry Project, at which I said a few words, and this is his poem. And the reason it's his poem is, there are a number of reasons, but one is that he had he was a lyricist as well as a poet, as well as a publisher, as well as Joe Brainard's partner. He wrote a poem called Sneaky Pete. And in the poem called Sneaky Pete is the refrain, whatever happened to the poem as poem, Sneaky Pete, whatever happened to the poem as poem. So that was, that line isn't here, but a piece of it is, as you will see, Blue Door. The obligatory cancels its strophe. Let me get a grip and begin in this other patch where the air is. Am I among the vanishing? How does it feel? As if turning, as if falling, as if coming unstuck from the body's inconvenience? Too many questions spoil the poem. The poem as poem cannot reply. Which is why we need more voices, even as we know what happens when there are more voices, noise, argument, rupture. Why not a single voice, one that represents everyone? Poem, are you listening? A crucible of dalliance supersedes Goldilocks and all other pending catastrophes angling toward power. As if on the last day you could recall power. If only the field could retract into a new beginning, intact, complex, the geography of the many seeding the plural world with accord, good replicating good, evil, singular, kept to its barren agenda. Prayers and wishes could then speed our recovery from the uninhabitable scald of the venal market. Not to be hysterical or polemical, not to confuse personal anxiety with the future. I was once at the Stray Dog Cabaret, once in unlit neighborhoods where sexy initiatives were underway awaiting Jim Jarmusch. Clubs, bars, sudden upswept encounters with the privileged poor, dancing with the stars. Meanwhile, another beginning in another district. I am seeing the headlights of an oncoming vehicle. I am seeing filmic snow. Oh, and I am stepping into the new day like a doe among bucks, a girl in sequins. I'm trying not to count lovers or shoes. Shoes gather episodic in twos. There are no agents, no inscriptions, as the story flows down into a rescinded pile. I have come to fear the punctuated day. I have come to wish I had done things differently, never to have begun with such sad disclosures. Absent the stanza, the difficult vocabulary, wandering barefoot along an avenue, before these piles, these sticks, the distant lamp of darkness, the distant lump of dark vestigial matter and skittering sounds from under the floor lasting until dawn, and so looking outward where skies assemble their beautiful reconnaissance, traveling as if beckoning, as if to include. There are countless children wandering, singles and plurals, one shoe, many children, or one child, many shoes. These discrepancies confuse the grammatical police. They do not know what to arrest. Please speak carefully, as this is a vote, and whether or not you have shoes, you need to say to choose whether or not. What undergirds these words? What might be found? A frugal sandal or the dazzling technicolor magic of the good witch's rubies? Everyone is after ruby slippers. We might sort through the archive of sneakers, the branded stores. We might look at the feet of strangers shod in tar and mildew, mud and blood, the goo trammeled underfoot like history. The southern sky has turned peachy. I would like to wear it out tomorrow as a slip, and so slip through the hole in the sky into the azure assembly, the tiered swerve from universe to universe in my new attire, looking for a mate or a moonstruck in the glitter of heaven. No guns allowed. If you listen carefully, you can hear the thrum of insomniac wings pulsating between episodes of cloud. In this atmosphere, nothing is shut, and so motion is the rule, motion without time, this time, our habit of counting up and counting down, speaking in numbers as if they were thought. In the distance, I hear the sound of a creature being slain by another creature. The beings I love are creatures. Is writing a way of stalling for time? To delay the tasks in the next room, dishes and clothes, books and papers, the pile of shoes on the floor, the rugs, the drawer chaotic with nails and hooks and small tools? Home is too busy to answer. Words are like small magnets, pulling other words toward them one by one. So the singles gather, and as they gather, they attest to an alignment that will become meaning. What was it you said about naming? It makes a way between unbeing and being, the definite flowing into the circulating infinite, the blue door opening the night sky. Thank you.
I'm going to remove this stand, and I think Charlie will come up. And...
check.
Words.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for inviting me. Thank you, Anne, very much for the reading. My name is Charles Schultz. I'm the managing editor of the Brooklyn Rail. I had the good fortune to have an advanced copy of this tremendous book of poems and had the privilege and pleasure of writing a piece about it over the winter months, which are cold months, and a good time to spend with not just these poems, but I spent them with a lot of Anne's poems and a lot of Anne's prose. And I have to say, from me to you, thank you very much for The Blue Door. I read it more times than I can count, and I heard it in so many different voices. And today I feel that I have really heard it, and I'm just so grateful. Not wishing to spoil the poetry with asking too many questions and being mindful of the fact that this is a day to celebrate mothers, I wanted to circle back to your grandma Shah. You told a great story about her not liking surprises, and I thought about how difficult COVID would have been for her. I thought about when, in the process of working on the book, did having her name at the very front felt important to you? And if there was one more funny story you would share about her?
She wasn't funny, but she was droll. She had a kind of a wit, I think she was quite brave, and I think she was quite interestingly of a time. And I think a lot about the fact that suddenly I am. I want to say, I'm aware of being vaguely conscious of three centuries, because my grandmother was a really true, marvelously Victorian person. She was quite privileged in her upbringing. She went to Smith College, graduated in the early part of the 20th century. Read a lot of books, had remarkable progressive politics for somebody of her, as I say, class. As I said, seemed to have managed to produce five girls, of whom my mother was the eldest, and probably the most troublesome. So there was Elizabeth, Nancy, Elizabeth, Alice, Nancy, Augustine, Priscilla. I think that the generation that followed those women, that's my generation, my cousins and I, feel peculiarly indebted to her for a certain kind of anchorage, because our lives, all of our lives, for various reasons, were kind of torn apart. And she seemed to not ever be torn apart. So, that's about all I can tell you.
Thank you. She sounds like the kind of matriarch that anchors a family that has three generations to come.
I don't know that she even liked the idea of being a matriarch, but never mind.
So, Anne, there's seven poems named Door, one named Blue Door in the book. And I wanted to ask two questions about that. One, I wanted to ask I made a guess in my essay about the Blue Door being a title piece, but I had not a sense of how it occurs in the progression of the door. others, and I was curious about that. And related to that progression, I was curious to ask how you decided to sequence them, because I felt that they were placed very well thoughtfully, but I was curious about that.
How I decided to sequence the doors?
Yes. Like a builder.
Well, I have a very strong spatial imagination, I think. It's probably much stronger than my temporal imagination. I don't know why I'm saying that, but I do think of things in space. I grew up on an apartment on 18th Street, and there were many doors in that apartment. And I think the whole idea of a threshold, of course, and closing and opening, all that came about sort of slowly in this. Well, all my books come about slowly. I don't have any intention in the first place, and I don't even know when there are enough poems for a book, except for, in this case, my wonderful editor from Penguin reminded me that there's one slot open for a book, and did I want it? So that'll make you pay attention very quickly. And I said, okay, yes. And then I thought, oh, I wonder if I have enough poems for the slot, the temporal slot. Maybe I should have called it slot. Blue slot. So then, you know, as some of you know, some of the other books that I've written, by the way, Jeffrey, there are 10 books, 11 books of poems in.
That's right, plus three essays.
Yeah.
Yes.
Who's counting? Many of them are divided into sections, and the sections are titled. And that has been some of the ways in which I've organized a book of poems. And this one is very clear to me that I couldn't do that, that there weren't going to be sections, and there weren't just these kinds of flows or pushes through or something. And then for some reason, the image of the door began to take... Well, I wrote the center poem, the long poem, which is 11 sections long. And I think that once that became like my grandmother, the anchor to the book. Then I began to think about the fact, oh, there could be other doors. And that's how that happened. And a couple of them weren't actually called door. And then I called them door. I said, oh, this could be a door.
I like that a lot. I like that the book starts with the world filling up, and it closes with an image of the poet moving into space. And I felt that that was particularly apt for a poet such as yourself, who's written so much about the night sky. And one of my favorite images in The Blue Door is the sequence where the speaker dons a dress of evening and ascends into the universe. Really just beautiful flows and transitions. And I would relate them, because it occurred to me, to Giotto, which I want to ask about. But the reason it came right to mind in relation to flying through the sky, thinking about you as a writer of the night, when I had the opportunity to visit Padua, one of the things that I was told I should not miss was the Star of Bethlehem. And the reason I was told that was because it was painted unlike any other Star of Bethlehem. It is a painting of a comet. It's an observation of what the star looked like, not a representation. And the idea of Giotto making that leap, seeing that in the sky, and placing that there, it made his, what he's taken from the night sky and what you've taken from the night sky, to seem of a piece. Mm. Apart from your generations, apart from your places. And I just wanted to share that observation. I guess I don't have a question that follows, but I wanted to share that observation. And then I will ask a basic question. Did you go to Padua?
I did, yes. I saw that, and it was really one of the most truly uncanny art moments in my life. And I was young. I was 21 or so when I saw it. And Jethro had then became a kind of key figure for me, and has been. So he's on the cover of Clamor, I think. I think that the aesthetic place of, well, the thing that I think maybe I'm interested in is not really so much the night as the place of material dissolving into immateriality and materiality and then both back and forth. So that current in Giotto is constant, and his care for the way in which there was a wonderful quote from T.J. Clark's book, Heaven on Earth, about blue. I can't think of what it is now. It's a wonderful sentence. Because he talks a lot about Giotto's blue and also gray. I think that, and also blue is, of course, Mary's color. But I think that when I first saw Giotto, and then later Matisse was very similar for me, this kind of interesting understanding that the world is a composition that you can invent, and that you can, and that idea of composing the world became very palpable for me. And it was a kind of understanding like, okay, there are these ingredients, and you can make something, you can compose something. You can make an arrangement, and the power of the arrangement as conveying more than one thing at the same time was always something that I just found was an ineluctable capacity of a human to do that. And that meaning is unstable and layered rather than simple and straightforward. And so, and it's difficult in poetry because it's linear. To do that in the same way of capturing a kind of singularity of the composition, but it's a really wonderful challenge to try and deal with that contradiction.
Contradictions are things that have tension built into them, and the tension, for me, is something that always has a kind of energy to it. One of the energies that I find in your work, and that I found when I was in the Arena Chapel in Padua, I found it easy to be attentive. I find that the attention is one of the highest things you can give to a thing. One of the lines that I particularly like in your poems is about attention. This was in the Ethos poem that you read tonight. Attention, is it preservation? What is it doing? And the response in the piece is that it is response. Attention needs response, and that's when it perhaps is most manifest.
But you know, William James said this wonderful thing about experience. His definition of experience is what we choose to attend to. And I think that's a core idea for anybody, but particularly for artists. So paying attention and attending to is together would maybe constitute what I'm calling response.
Mm-hmm. I agree, and it makes me think of actually something that I learned from David Levi Strauss when I was in his writing program. I asked him one time when he thought about this particular artist, and he said, "I'm not sure, and I won't know until I write about it." And I think what he meant, and which I don't think I understood at the time, was that the return on the attention given wouldn't really be there until something was made. And I think that that's that urge to make from the observation is really...
Yeah, I think I construe that slightly differently, which is that I urge my students and myself to always write from the known into the unknown. So the conversion of knowledge into a place of doubt or uncertainty is what gives me pleasure. So, and I'm not interested in writing from the place of the known, right? So it's an interesting thing because it's really about pressing oneself right into the present. And then saying, okay, the present is obligated to cause a future, right? If you stay only in what you know, you can't make a future. You can only do it by putting what you know at risk to the future. So the poems, when they're really happy for me, is when they surprise me. You know, when they do that, and then when they go to someplace I had no idea in the beginning they were going to go.
Wander into strangeness.
Yeah.
Time is canceled.
Yeah.
Yes. How about that?
Well, it's very erotic, also. Sorry, just I have a memory.
Jeffrey, are we okay on time?
I think we're doing well. Maybe one more prompt, and then we do have Kelly from the wonderful Spotty Dog Books now here, and we will, after the next bit of chat, we'll part the ways and allow her to get back to the table where we can put a pile of books.
Do we want to ask persons here to...
You're certainly welcome, and I'll ask that you repeat any question that's asked. Please keep them concise so that it goes into the recording.
Yeah, before we move into a phase of book buying and book signing, would anyone like to have a moment with the microphone? I'm happy to share. Absolutely.
You just twist it around, I think. Yeah.
Hi, Ed. So I was kind of, something that surprised me in your reading was how plentiful your poems were, but that there wasn't, and that they were kind of accumulating, but then I wasn't left with a kind of like overwhelming fullness, and that there was some sense of like putting down or like disappearance or like as we were kind of moving through it. And I guess this is a little bit more of just an observation, but I would be curious to hear what you had to say about the kind of quality of disappearance in your work.
I have a poem called "Dis" in here. That if we had time, I would read. It's a prose poem. It's about disappearance, and it says, actually, the line. But the line at the end of this very dark poem, which if it were a sunny, beautiful day, I would have read. But there's just so much we can do to torque. And there was one real winter poem. I thought that'll be enough. Where is it? Here it is. Dis. So, so it ends this way. If you're waiting for the figure, it will not emerge. The image is bare, which is why I must forsake it, to protect it from the cruelty of the emulating shadow with its arrogant intimacy, its false embrace in the flare of lit space, candles dawn, that slit of moon. Dangerous and sly, unable to form the slightest attachment, the merest touch with its object, it caresses the night with an affinity so entire it cannot be discerned. You see, don't you, how appearance is a form of betrayal. So there's a sort of the slippage, or the idea of language as a kind of slippage, I think is important. It's a wonderful question, thank you. And it's also a kind of desire to sit the poems down so gently that they don't really conclude. And it's an interesting thing to try and teach. It's like talking about edges in painting. It's the same kind of problem. Like if you don't, I was his name just ran out of my head. Painter.
Yeah.
Say.
Richter.
Yeah, I was at the Richter show last week in New York at wherever that is. David Swartner. And I became fascinated in looking at those paintings, the 16 paintings that are there, at his edge, you know, in the way I thought this is a person who truly understood what an edge is, which isn't an edge. The edge that isn't an edge, and I'm interested in the ending that isn't an ending. It's the same kind of idea. Because I think if you make an ending that's rigid and satisfying, you're never going to read the poem again. It has to be something that does something like that, like a piece of music, you know, like you just want to go back and come through it again.
Great question. Can I pass the mic to anyone else?
Yeah, and I was like told my friends, I was like, I'm going to be really embarrassed and like found girl, I'm going to like say a quote of yours to you, which is super cool, that I just read today and was like, that's brilliant. And this was, I don't remember what interview this was in, but you said, I began to give up the use of classical syntax, the logic of cause and effect of an assumed relation between subject and object after my sister died. The narrative as story had been ruptured once and for all. I wanted the gaps to show. And I recently lost my sister, and so that spoke to me in an incredibly profound way. And this is incredibly selfish, but in my own processing, like I wanted to ask about grief and that rupture and how you played with it, how you used it, how you processed it. If I may.
Wow. A slight little question.
I'm sorry. If I may not, that is fine too.
No, I mean, these poems in this book are, I didn't read some of the floating poems tonight. They are much more syntactically intact than usual. And that quote that you read, I think, is from the whole fragment, maybe. So there was this moment that was after a series of losses, actually, and my sister's being the kind of most severe, although was predated by my father's some years before, and then many cousins, and so on. A lot of dying in the early days. And my sister was very young. To die, she was young. And I realized that the only way to accommodate that absence was to make an absence, or to make the rupture apparent, not write about it, write into it, make it be, because any attempt to circumvent the gap would be a lie. The gap is not circumventable. So it needs to appear as such. And so that is very literal in a way, but it is, and then I came to a new understanding through that, which was much more positive, which was that, oh, the fragment is a beautiful thing, and that a fragment is, this is the argument in that piece, a fragment is not a torn piece of a whole, but in itself has value, and that if we moved from fragment to fragment without this expectation of entirety or everything is going to be, you know, follow rightfully from one place to another, and we're all going to live happily ever after, all of that should be given up. And then I think the idea of the whole fragment is probably very close to a kind of Buddhist understanding of the present, right? So you stay close to the now, then you really don't suffer quite so much at the losses that always are surround the now, always, inevitably. And they're the ones that are close to us and they're the ones that are far away. And so if you begin to understand, oh, I see the gesture of the fragment is really useful as a way to feel not that you're not living inside of a constant grief. I think I wrote to somebody whose friend is dying, one of my wonderful students, whose name is Dan Beachy-Quick, a wonderful poet. I haven't seen him for years and years and years, and we had this correspondence. And he's in Chicago now with his family, and one of his close friends is dying. And he wrote and he said, it's so peculiar to sit with my dying friend and make jokes and has, you know, he's confused. This is the first of his dear people to die. And I wrote to him and I said, grief is really the shock of being alive. It's really what it is. It is not only that you miss the person, but it's actually, grief is really this sort of sense of I'm still alive and I suffer from that because someone else is not. It's very complicated. I realize that a large part of grief has something to do with the grief of being alive.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for that question. Thank you for that.
Nice, Jeffrey. Thank you so much, Charles and Anne, for being here. I'll just say that one of the poems that I didn't read, A Door Becomes a Dare, which I read as an invitation. And so I just want to thank you for the invitation to go for the unknown, to enjoy the fragment as whole. And I invite all of you now to move toward the back where we have books available. And please join me in thanking Charles and Anne for being here.
I was pretty sure we'd seen it before.
Yeah.